Now on the Business Radio X Network, just Ask the Gals, social media solutions and education.
Welcome to Tucson Business Radio X and our show, Ask the Gals. My name is Jessica Badowski, and I'm one of the founders of Too Busy Gals, a local company that provides social media services to nonprofit organizations and businesses. We like to say we help you your social media work for you so you don't have to work for it. Today, our topic, I am so excited. I cannot tell you. So maybe 2 weeks or so ago, there was a salon, not a hair salon or a nail salon. There was a thought talking salon down at the YWCA, and a variety of women's organizations were there, including the League of Women Voters, talking about the 19th Amendment and various progress that women have made and additional progress to be made. And this intrigued me as a business owner. Those of you who've listened to the podcast, you know, we're always picking apart what are challenges, what are ways that women can be striving and doing more in business. And we frequently say, and what are we seeing on social media about that? Because at the end of the day, we're a social media business. So I'm very excited to have three guests with us here today from the League of Women Voters. I'm going to start with Vivian. If you could just introduce yourself and tell us what your role at the League is.
I'm Vivian Hart, and I'm the president of the League of Women Voters of Greater Tucson.
Thank you for joining us. Susan.
I'm Susan Black, and I am the program chair for the League of Women Voters of Greater Tucson.
Excellent. And Jennifer.
I'm Jennifer Dawson. I'm a civilian. I joined the League last February, and I'm delighted to be here.
Wonderful. A little bit of my history with the League of Women Voters. Way back in maybe 1988, 89, I became aware of the League of Women Voters in Indiana, Pennsylvania, and Indiana County. We are famous for Christmas trees and Jimmy Stewart. We are about, we're probably about 65 miles, mostly east, slightly north of Pittsburgh. So it's coal mining town, Appalachia. At any rate, the League of Women Voters was recommended to me by a professor because I was a political science major. So in my first life, I was very interested in possibly running for office, possibly being an attorney. I wasn't quite sure, but something in that field because of experiences I had had. And I had some really awesome high school experiences. So I actually interned and got a small scholarship, but it was, I think, $250 from the League of Women Voters. And I don't know, I was responsible for copying or passing things out at monthly meetings. It wasn't a very large chapter. I mean, the town's under like 40,000, so it wasn't a whole lot of people. But I just loved the message of the League of Women Voters about we want people to vote, right? And at that time, people were not denying the League of Women Voters to do debates, at least at the local level. And one of the things I found so useful as a voter was the questionnaire, the survey questionnaires that they had where various people running for office would answer the questionnaire. And I always felt like, if you didn't feel like answering all the questions, how hard are you going to work for me? Right. Mm. And I also felt like, who wouldn't answer the questions for the League of Women Voters? So that's just a little bit of my long ago history. And so I'm interested to hear a little bit about how you knew about or came to the League of Women Voters. What were you doing before that made this interesting? So we're not in any particular order. Whoever wants to jump in, jump in.
Well, I'm Vivian, and my background is I have a sociology degree. That's my bachelor's degree. And a minor in political science. And I know from understanding sociology, to understand what a society is and the trends of a society, you look at the politics.
Mm-hmm.
And our society goes back and forth and back and
Absolutely.
Forth.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
The way I got involved in the League of Women Voters just a few years ago was I got a survey from National League. And some of the questions had to do with voter suppression. And I'm concerned about voter suppression throughout the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, if this organization is working with that, I am going to be part of it. And actually, just to let you know, National League of Women Voters is starting a new project. They're having people from all the 50 states come to Virginia in October to work on a new project of redistricting, because now that the Supreme Court said that we need to either have independent commissions
mm-hmm.
or go to state courts in order to deal with redistricting, that's what the League is going to start working on throughout the entire country now.
And that is so fascinating because I did a anti-poverty before social media company. For 20 years, I did anti-poverty social work programs, right? And worked in various, mostly as a trainer and a speaker at different levels of programs around the country. And one of the things that just drove me batty, and everybody was guilty of it, as soon as one party got in charge, they redistrict in a crazy way. The other party got in charge, they redistrict in a crazy way. So it was like there were no reasonable actors in a way, right? It was like, oh, we're going to do it now. You're going to do it now. We're going to do it now. So I think just that concept of, you know, is just fascinating that we're moving towards a time for more transparency.
Correct.
So it's just really interesting that that project is at the forefront, and that's kind of what brought you to the organization. Mm-hmm. How about you, Susan? What got you involved?
So what got me involved at the time, I was living in Illinois, and I had been involved with a lot of nonprofit organizations during my professional life, and I stopped my involvement with one of the groups, and I said, I'm looking for something different. But interestingly enough, I didn't really say, oh, it's the League of Women Voters, and they're committed to X. I basically said, okay, the League looks like a very interesting organization, and I'm going to get involved. And I basically started out, I didn't have any goal, like I'm going to be president, or I'm going to be this, or anything like that. I just would always throw myself in and really put my best foot forward. One thing led to another with my involvement in the League of Women Voters. I became the president of my local league in Evanston, Illinois, and served in that role.
I know where Evanston, Illinois is.
Right. I was in that role for 3 years, but I was also working full-time at Northwestern University. And I was always looking for new ways to make an impact on society. And this really fit the bill.
What were you doing at Northwestern?
What I was doing at Northwestern, I was working with a program that was devoted to educating undergraduate students in biological sciences, like on a pre-med track.
Sure.
But at the same time, we were developing a new academic program that was a graduate program in plant biology and conservation that was in sponsorship with the Chicago Botanic Garden.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
And it was really, really an amazing opportunity. And I really took that from a small nucleus. And after 10 years, had really developed it into a, you know, a really well-known academic program where our students really went on and had great success. But it was also very exciting to be able to talk about these innovative things that I had done with the students and with that program. And then I worked in the Northwestern Center for Water Research.
Okay.
Which was another totally different avenue to go down. But I seemed to keep attracting myself to working in technical environments, but I wasn't. I was a sociology major, just like Vivian.
Interesting.
I didn't know that.
Right, exactly. So you just...
The journey continues, doesn't it? It's like it's where it needs to go.
Right.
My master's degree was at Ohio State University, and it's in African American Studies and Community Development. And I was part of a very small cohort, and we're on, you can't see us, but I just got this little raised eyebrow from Jennifer, like, really? And a little eyebrow went up. I was the only European American Caucasian person in the, we only had a cohort of about 10. It was a tiny program, so it wasn't like hundreds of people. It was like, oh, I was the only one. I mean, there were 10 of us, so I was 10%. Like, not overstate it. But worked on community development, and that kind of was me. I decided I didn't want to go to law school, and I thought maybe I was going to get a PhD. And then it's like, oh, I don't know. I did some multicultural ed. And then I said, oh my gosh, I have to get a job and make some money. Like, you got to get out of this. You can't just go to school forever. You're like, you know, you can only eat so.
Why not?
Well, you can only eat so much SpaghettiOs. And so eventually, like, I need a job. But I feel like that path really was set by those early looking at, you know, the political science and really looking at civics in a really structured way. And I keep finding in this day and age, so many people have little to no knowledge of civics. They have lots of frustration of how things are going, but little to no knowledge of how this system is set up and where we can make changes, right? You know, and how we can make changes. And so that's been very enlightening to me in kind of this season of my life. Jennifer, how did you come to be with Legal Women Voters? You're the newbie.
I'm the newbie. The rookie. And my background is nothing like anybody else here. Wow.
Which is awesome because we need diversity on these at these tables.
I spent my life in theater. I've been an actor from way back. So I spent a lot of my time early on when dinosaurs walked the earth. I did television commercials in New York. Then I ended up doing some regional theater, nothing that you would ever remember. And then I spent a lot of time doing outdoor festivals, Renaissance festivals around the country.
Sure.
So I got really used to standing up in front of people and doing really stupid stuff and not paying much attention to politics at all. So with that being said, I also have to say that I am basically an introvert. And I have a sign on the back of my car that says, thanks, you've turned me into an introvert. Because 2 years ago, I woke up like the rest of the country and went, oops. And I started by writing just a little newsletter among friends of here's what's happening. Here's who you where you can get some more information.
Sure.
Here's who you might want to talk to, blah, blah, blah. And that slowly grew. And then I thought, I need to do some more. And so I ended up, among other things, coming to a League of Women Voters meeting, I think it was last February, and going, oh, this is interesting. And I don't know that I'm never planning to be a mover and shaker, but what fascinated me was suddenly starting to read about the history and how we are once again fighting the same battles that we've literally been fighting for 200 years. And I was going, whoa. So my feeling is I like to tell stories. I like to communicate. I like to tell people what happened before and say, this is what we might do now.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of feel that I want to just give other people information.
Sure.
So they can make their own decisions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well,
but I'm by no means a dyed-in-the-wool political person. Not at all. This is all brand new. I saw a sign at a rally at one point that described me perfectly. A very kind of nice, quiet, nerdy-looking guy holding a sign. And it said, you know it's bad when the introverts show up.
Ah. Uh-huh.
So that's me.
I was going to say that sociology tells stories.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is, looking at the story of the change in society over time.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the biggest challenges we find as social media consultants is a lot of people, businesses, nonprofits, when they come to us, have a very specific outcome. I need to raise $5,000 for this fundraiser. I need to get employees. I want customers to come in the door. And if we pay you, I need to be able to know every person who ticks through that door that was influenced by you. And they kind of miss the whole point of social media. All of these platforms, for good and for bad, are really connecting to the human need to share story in community.
To network, to communicate, to be part
of
a
group. To communicate with others. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things in our life in modern society that have, for various reasons, we don't participate. I call them the critter clubs. My dad's an elk and a moose, right? I think I'm some sort of elkette by generation or something. I'm like fourth generation elkette. Okay, they're not called elkettes. You can be a full elk now. But there are some people in his thing that are like, yeah, we have women now. I'm like, get with it. But my dad is like, he's 77. He's like, do I need to be on Facebook? I'm like, oh, heavens, no. But part of that around, he has so many communities to socialize and share in. He's one of those people who has never met a stranger. He can get the whole story from the waitress. Like, she's sharing intimate life details over, like, the order just because he's a communicator. He has a theater background.
Right.
So when you said regional theater, I was like, oh, yeah, you want to talk about the Catskills in the summers in the 60s. You might have passed by my dad at some point. But I think we miss what I find most powerful as a user and a professional in social media is the ability to tell and share story.
Mm-hmm.
It's so incredibly powerful, and there's so many ways to do it. And I really do feel like for all the bad that's not worked out, that the technology is ahead of humans, we haven't figured out how to handle things, people, nefarious people misusing it. Well, you know, sometimes I drive down I-10 and I go, wow, you can buy a billboard that says that. Shouldn't there be rules about that? I don't agree with that. Oh, well, I guess free speech, First Amendment. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I think through my mind, you know, those pieces. you know, these are billboards on our computers we're looking at, and we have the choice to engage with it, not engage with it, look away, not look away, decide to take action if we feel we need to take action. But that storytelling, it's interesting to me that we have a table full here of women who are like, in different ways, how do we tell story? How do we share story? So getting to that point, one of the reasons I thought this would be an interesting dialogue to have, one, to have the opportunity to get more information out about the League of Women Voters, because I think more people need to know about the work and the history. So tell me a little bit about the history of the League of Women Voters. How did it come to be?
That's me.
Oh, okay.
Whoopee. Okay. One little blurb I want to add before I actually get into that. I read a very sad little story the other day of a young girl who's maybe 13, and she was wishing that it could be like the old days, like 10 years before, where you could just chill out and hang out with your friends and go on dates and have fun, and nobody was doing that because they were all on their cell phones. Mm. And I thought, honey, just put it down, you know, and tell your friends to put it down and all go to the movies together. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so, all right. 19th Amendment. Where to begin? We can go back to about 1,000 years ago with what was called the Onondaga, and is now, I'm going to pronounce it correctly, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, my apologies for that, who had basically a society where women were equal. Women had power on whether or not to go to war. Women had power on voting who was going to be the chief. If the husband brought home skins that could be sold, the money went to the women. The women chose the prices. Very much an egalitarian society. In the early 18th century, women were able to vote in the colonies, and it didn't stop until about 1777 in New York, and women were voting in New Jersey until 1807. And then the Constitution was ratified, and when the idea came down that states would now decide on election laws, all the votes were taken away from the women. All right?
Well, wait a minute. I want to tell a story.
Please tell a story.
About that, and that is, so Benjamin Franklin was trying to figure out what kind of a government should we have, and he visited the Iroquois Nation. And the Iroquois Nation was made up of five or six different Native American tribes that had been fighting each other.
Onondaga, Mohawk, Seneca, Oneida, and Cayuga, later joined by the Tuscarora.
Exactly.
Here we go.
And of those are six, right?
Yeah, it started out five. Tuscarora joined later, then it was six.
So they lived in this great big house that each group had their own part of this long, long house. And five out of the six tribes, only men could be elected, but only women could vote.
Yeah.
So,
isn't that nice?
Interestingly enough, Benjamin Franklin didn't totally copy that model. Only men could be elected, and only men with property could vote. So he just cut out women entirely.
I didn't know we could blame him specifically, but I will from now on.
But that was from the idea from Europe.
Yes.
These were European ideas about the status of women being only half a human being of what a man was.
Right. And part of that was when the Enlightenment basically died with the French Revolution. Mary Wollstonecraft had written in 1792 A Vindication of the Rights of Women, where she wasn't necessarily advocating the vote, but she was advocating education, because she said, how can you have a reasonable society when half the people in it are stupid? That's a serious paraphrase, but that's what she was going after. If you want women to be productive and contribute, you have to educate them. Okay,
correct.
So fast forward to 1848, Seneca Falls. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton, at this point, had been living in Seneca Falls. She had seven kids, and she thought, this isn't fun, because she had grown up in Boston, and she was used to being with a whole lot of exciting people, and here she was kind of in the boonies. And so she and a group of friends got together and said, you know, we're going to have a convention about the rights of women. And they set it up in about 2 weeks, and they had no idea that anybody was going to show up. And in July 1848, first day, it was a two-day convention, first time there had ever been a women's convention, 300 people showed up. Wow. The place was mopped.
That's a lot of people.
And the next day, it was mopped even more. And they went, oh, wow. And Elizabeth brought out what she called her Declaration of Sentiments. And I'm just going to read you the first sentence. Okay. Bear in mind that up to this point, women were a legal non-entity. As soon as you got married, everything that you were was subsumed into your husband. You had no rights over your children. You had no rights over your own property. You had no rights over yourself. You couldn't vote. Nothing. Okay.
Let me tell you a story about that by Elizabeth Cady Stanton. When she was a girl, her father was a lawyer.
Yeah.
And
this
woman came to him and said,
I love this story.
You know what? My husband died. My son wants to kick me out of our house. And he said, unfortunately, you have no rights at all because you're a woman. You have to get out of your house. She said, well, I'm going to be destitute. I can't work. I have no one to support me. And he said, sorry, that's the law. Your son owns all the property. All property goes from male to male to male to male.
Yeah.
It is never.
Doesn't matter if you brought it into the marriage. Mm-hmm. It's no longer yours.
Right.
And then Elizabeth went to her father's law book. She said to the woman, and she said, well, I'll just cut all those laws out of the law books, and then everything will be fine. She was about 10 years old at the time. Okay, so anyway.
Okay, I'm glad she was 10, because I was a little concerned about where.
Well, she didn't know. Okay, so Declaration of Sentiments. What you need to know, when she wrote this, it was modeled on the Declaration of Independence, which everybody knew. You grew up with it. You'd memorized it. You heard it every 4th of July. So she got to the point, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. And that was an absolute, total bombshell. Not only was she speaking in public, which women never did. If you had to speak in public, you didn't. You had a man do it for you. And here she was saying men and women were created equal. Whoopsie, there we go. Okay, so this caused a huge upheaval. And this was the beginning of what then became a series of women's national conventions across the country. From about 1850 on, they began to pop up all over the place. Okay. Now, also in 1860, which you know about because it's on your sheets there, there was the 1848, there was a Married Women's Property Act in New York. This was a little bit before Seneca Falls. Women could own and control their land and their personal property. What you brought into your marriage now belonged to you and could not be taken by your husband's creditors. This was a huge deal because if you were married to somebody who was abusive or drunk, he would take your land and sell it, and you were destitute. And this also meant that suddenly there was a split economically between husband and wife. They were no longer just one person. And throughout this whole period, there was a big argument between the two spheres, the male sphere and the female sphere. And the man went out into the world and was brave and daring, and the woman stayed home and took care of the kids. We've all heard this endless numbers of times.
Do you find that it appeared to me when I did some of the research for the show today that there were consistently little, I don't want to say little places, but at the local or state level, movement towards change, right?
Yes.
So for example,
yes,
this was in New York, that there were different places where things popped up, but not consistently on a national scale.
There were different women, if I can barge in.
Anybody jump in, please.
Different women doing things in different areas. Clarina Nichols, whom you never hear about, was out in Kansas. And she was canvassing for women's suffrage out Kansas, Wyoming, further west. She had a newspaper for a while that she took over after her husband was unable to do it because he became ill. And there were little conventions, little groups popping up all over the place. Some of them had more effect than others. But once the word began to get out, people were going, we could actually do something like this. So from about 1850 on, there were all kinds of little conventions happening. Some were much bigger than others. There was a big one in 1850. They had the first national women's rights convention in Worcester, Massachusetts, of all places. And Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass showed up at that one. And then later on, we got into, and in 1860, we got another Married Women's Property Act in New York. Once again, go New York. You had the right, this is the biggie, the right to own your own businesses, the right to sue and be sued. You could keep the money that you made, and you had joint custody of your children. Unfortunately, when the Civil War broke out, New York State repealed the part about the joint custody. But after this initial one in 1860, suddenly there you were. You could have your own business. And that was a huge point gained. And slowly, gradually, over the next 20 years, more colleges were opening to women, more professions were opening to women. But the biggie, the one thing that people were really fighting for, was they still did not have the vote.
What was happening, though, was that some of the Western states were getting the vote for women.
And I have a great story about Wyoming.
Go ahead and tell the story about Wyoming.
All right. Wyoming was a territory in 1869. They were the first territory to give women the vote. There were four others.
I'm really glad Jennifer is the newbie who's just on board, but it's like, this happened in this year, this happened in this state.
I put this all together, it's going, oh my God, this is amazing. Okay, Wyoming, 1869, and then there were four others. There was Colorado, there was Utah, and Idaho. They all gave women votes when they were still territory. However, 1869, Wyoming gives women the vote. 1890, Wyoming becomes a state. And the federal government says, you can't be a state, your women have the right to vote. And the governor of Wyoming said back, we come in with our women or we don't come in at all.
Ooh, good for him.
Really?
That's the kind of ally you want, right?
Like
using position.
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought?
Yeah.
You know? So, and also there's an interesting map here that says, there's states that gave women the vote before they became territories that gave women the vote before they became states, states that gave women the vote before the 19th Amendment was passed, and of course, unfortunately, the states that delayed in giving the vote to women the latest were mostly the southern states. But
so,
you know,
we became a state in Arizona in 1912. No women could vote. However, the very first initiative that we had on the ballot was giving women the right to vote. And I saw a poster of the suffragettes, and it was a really interesting poster. So you had all these states in the West where women could vote, and all these states in the Midwest and East where they couldn't, and the South. And so there's this woman standing on top of the Western states, and these women are swimming over towards the West because they're, that's it. Women.
This is a,
now you can't see this, but we will share it on social media because you know we share our podcast on social media.
I'm sorry, it's radio, but this is a picture. It's called The Awakening. And on the Western states, there's a woman in Grecian-style dress with her robes flowing out behind her. And on the robes are written votes for women. And the eastern half of the United States, you see women, it's like they're in the La Brea tar pit, struggling to get out.
We will share this on Too Busy Y'all's Facebook page so that people can see access to it.
It is a wonderful.
It's a gorgeous picture.
Wonderful
picture. I have a question for Susan. So I am loving this, but just in case we have listeners who are like, great, thanks for the history. What can I do now? We like to meet all levels of listeners. So what are some things right now, if people are getting inspired by what we're sharing, that are going on? I know you handle some of the education and outreach activities.
Yes, I do. And that's a very important component of our work is the League of Women Voters.
And then we're getting back to the history because I like that part.
Right. So, but what's interesting is that usually when you mention that you are involved with the League of Women Voters, they say, oh, you register voters. And I was like,
That's true.
It's not a lie. But I said, we need to impress upon the community that we do so many other things that are so much in the advocacy area. I mean, there's so much apathy in this world today, and we need to fight that apathy and get people engaged again with learning about what's going on with their government.
Education is the name of the game, really.
Right. And education is power for the,
absolutely,
for the League of Women.
So how can listeners get involved with Tucson's League of Women Voters or their local chapter, wherever they may be?
Right. So one of the things that we do in the League of Women Voters is we have our voter education programs. And our voter education programs are held on the third Saturday of every month from September to March. Mm-hmm. And we have these meetings down at the Valdez branch of the Pima County Public Library. Downtown Library at 101 North Stone. We have them on Saturday mornings. They start with a little social time at 9:30 and then at 10 o'clock we get into year and we have our presentations. I can tell you some of the programs we did last year because they were all fantastic. And we have another totally new slate of things that we're doing this year.
And don't you also live stream those programs?
Yes, we do live stream those meetings. Absolutely.
Okay, so if you're in your jammies and you just can't get down there, you can go to the League of Women Voters website.
Go to the League of Women Voters Facebook page. Yep. Right, exactly.
Facebook page.
Yep.
Facebook Live.
Okay. Right. So if I could just share some titles that we did last year. How to be an informed voter in the post-truth era.
Oh.
I mean, there was a lot of concern around fake news. Then we had, because it was an election year, we talked about some of the Arizona ballot measures. We always want to educate the public on some of these topics that can have a controversy.
Well, sometimes they're written backwards, right? So, like,
very
if
confusing.
You vote yes, it actually
means no.
And if you vote no, it means yes. It's in a very convoluted reverse.
Yes, right. Exactly. Yeah. Another program we did, which had a very huge turnout, was the topic Severed Ties, the Legal and Humanitarian Impact of U.S. Immigration Policy. And that really got things really percolating. Then we know that in 2020, we're going to be doing the U.S. Census. So we felt it was our duty as a civic organization to educate people and impress upon them the importance of doing, you know, participating in the census. And we held it at the library that was over in Valencia. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to reach out to neighborhoods that might not understand what was going on. So we really try to do a little bit more outreach by having our meetings in different places. But for the most part, all of our meetings have been held down at the Valdez Library downtown. In March, we did a presentation on the Arizona Corporation Commission. Mm. And the Arizona Corporation Commission is so essential to citizens in Arizona and helping them understand these people regulate our utilities. And we took that and really laid everything out so people would understand the importance of what the ACC does. And then a program we usually do in March had to do with the environment. So last March, we had a presentation by people who were involved with the Citizens Climate Lobby, of which I'm now participating. And this was all about climate change in Arizona and what can and should we do. Now, that was last year.
Excellent.
But those programs were so amazing in terms of bringing people in or having, if you looked at our live stream numbers, they were so impressive. It was amazing. Now, this time, this in a couple weeks, on September 21st, we have probably one of the premier issues in politics today, and that's talking about the Electoral College.
Oh.
And the question we are posing is, should the presidential candidate with the most votes win? So that will definitely be a program that the public will want to know about. So,
and that's September 21st.
September 21st.
And we will continue to have that discussion for a long time, I anticipate.
That won't go away.
No.
Another program we'll be doing in October is looking at the issue of funding education in Illinois.
Sometimes I forget and I live in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I don't know where your brain goes for that.
Right. So the title of this is very catchy. Duct tape. Patching public education in a low-tax state.
You're getting into the marketing language. I like it. Let me just hop in here just for a second and remind folks that they are listening to Ask the Gals on Tucson Business Radio X. You can find us on the web. And today we're talking about the 19th Amendment, the League of Women Voters, the role of women in carving out some space in legal legislation and also in their roles and abilities to be fully functioning citizens. So I want to thank all of our guests here today. We're not ending. I'm just thanking you at the half hour. We've got Jennifer Dawson and Susan Black and Vivian Hart from the League of Women Voters. So Susan, keep telling us, we've got something coming up on September 21st. We got something coming up in October.
Yes. Then in November, we'll talk about development versus affordable housing. Because we know every place we go, I mean, I found this in Illinois and I'm finding it here just as well. All these developers have to get their new developments out there and they're destroying neighborhoods. And it's not appropriate for the citizenry. In January, we are going to be talking about income inequality. In February, we'll talk about guns and trying to find common ground. In March, for our environmental program, I believe our topic is going to be talking about buffalo grass and the Sonoran Desert.
Which I did not ever, had never heard of before I moved here, because it's not really an issue in Ohio.
Yes. And
crabgrass is a big issue.
Crabgrass, right, exactly. We'll do a special program in April that will be talking about the charter school study that the League did for, you know, a few years ago. And our members would like to have an update on where that is, because there are certainly a lot of hot button issues that are still out there on the charter school question. So that's. And for right now, I'm going to, that's one thing I'll talk about, and then maybe we'll circle back to me and I'll talk about our units and what happens in our unit meetings.
Excellent.
Because I believe that's how Jennifer first got involved with one of the,
I wandered into the meeting. I happened to look up online which one was closest to me, which was the one at Swan. And I wandered in and went, oh, this is interesting. I had no clue.
Right,
exactly. I was completely
just
ignorant.
Proving a point. You never know.
You never know.
And you need to be open to all possibilities.
Walk through that door and a whole new world opens up to you.
Right, exactly.
I'd like to point out that the League of Women Voters has three main areas that we work in. One is voter registration and get out the vote. We go to numerous events having to do with voter registration throughout our community. And then we also do get out the vote. And we did a really special thing in 2018. We took cards, like business cards, they looked like business cards, that were laminated. And on one side was information on how to register to vote, and the other side was about the various ways to vote in Pima County. And these cards were taken to business owners in the part of the city that has the lowest voting rate, and that's the southern part. If you look at a map of Tucson, you see the northern part votes in the greatest percentages, and then as you go southward, you find it's a less and less and less percentage. So by the time you get down to the southern part of the city, only about 50% of registered voters actually vote. So our Get Out the Vote committee took these cards to small businesses, talked to the business owners and the business managers, and said, would you please give these cards to the people who work for you? Because we know that those people will influence the employees much more than us going in and saying, here, you need to vote. So it was an excellent thing that we did with that. Also having to do with that are, we also have publications. One of them is a citizens directory that has a list of all of the national, state, and local people who represent us.
I have that right next to my computer. I could not live my life without it. It's wonderful.
I love that pamphlet.
And then we
print more next year. Let's get you a sponsor.
That would be great. Then another thing, that we're running out of them. We have so many people. We have,
I know,
it's fabulous.
Thousands, and we give them away. And then we also have a one sheet, a long one sheet, and it on one side is English and the other side is Spanish, about the basics about voting in Pima County. And we give away thousands of those. We give those out through the library system. And we also have forums where we have candidates come in and talk about what they are, what kind of vision they have, and answer questions from the audience. Our next one actually is on September 26th. We're having candidates for the mayor's office and the city council offices. So that's one part of what we do. Another part is the voter education that Susan just talked about. And then the third part is advocacy. We have people, not our group, but on the state level, the State League of Women Voters has lobbyists that go to the state legislature. They go to committee hearings, And they work with those people to let the views of the League of Women Voters be known. We have what we call positions. Susan mentioned we're having a study done on charter schools. What we do is we study whatever the issue is. We're good sociologists. We study whatever the issue
study
is.
Study the question,
and
right?
Then we come upon what we think is the healthiest. Because we're mothers and grandmothers. And what we're trying to do is, what is the healthiest for the individual? What's the healthiest for the family, for the community, for the society, for the world? And our positions on the local, state, and national levels are all based on those studies and what we think would help people thrive. And that's, so on the advocacy level, we do that on the state level, but we also have a speakers bureau here in Tucson. If anyone is interested in having a speaker, let us know, because one of the things, in addition to the 19th Amendment, one of the things we speak about is how to sign up for the Request to Speak program.
Which is wonderful.
You sit in your pajamas at home.
Oh, it's democracy in your jammies. I love it. I use
yes.
it all the time.
And you're on your computer, and you can go in and put your opinion, both your comments as well as your thumbs up or your thumbs down.
And you can do it at 3 o'clock in the morning if
exactly.
you're in Insomniac.
That's on great. The bills in the state legislature.
I feel like there's something very interesting happening at Jennifer's house, but well, that's probably another show.
If you see the lights flashing in the dead of night, it means I'm on Request to Speak.
Okay.
Those are the three main areas of the League of Women Voters. We are 300 members strong. We are one of the
That's a sizable chapter.
We are one of the larger chapters in the country.
Yeah, I would definitely think so.
Very active. We have many, many other things going on too, but those are our main things that we concentrate on.
So can we just talk a little bit, and then we're going to have to like jump past the 19th Amendment. But how then did the League of Women Voters, like what is the history of that as an organization? How did that come to be an organization?
Okay, back to me. Originally, there was the National American Women's Suffrage Association. Then after the Civil War, they got into a big fight because they had been supporting abolition and the 13th Amendment, and women were not included when black men got the vote. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were absolutely outraged and felt totally betrayed because all along, before the Civil War, women had been supporting abolition, and a lot of the men in the abolition movement had been supporting women's suffrage. Now, all of a sudden, there was a diversion, and all the men were saying, no, no, you'll have to wait. So the organization split into the National Women's Suffrage Association and the American Women's Suffrage Association. The acronyms get confusing after a while. And basically, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were with the National. They were much more radical. They said they were never going to work with men again. No man could hold office in the organization. And they would not support black men voting. The American Association was much more conservative and said, we're going to work on a state-by-state level. And we're going to work for women's votes that way. And yes, we'll deal with men, and that's absolutely fine. The National Association had also said that they were going to work for a federal amendment, which actually they got a California representative to pass. In 1872, it was called the Susan B. Anthony Amendment. It did not pass. They brought it before Congress for the next 42 years. Anyway, so there was a split for about 30 years. Then in 1890, things had sort of ground to a halt. Nothing much was happening. And they said, all right, we're going to reunite again. And they became, guess what? The National American Women's Suffrage Association. Okay. And at this point, the old guard, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, were just getting too old to carry on. So a new group came up. And what eventually happened was, after the 19th Amendment was passed, the National American Women's Suffrage Association became the League of Women Voters.
Because they needed a shorter name so people could remember it.
I hope so.
Right.
That's all I
right.
did. Because after you're going, NASA, AWSA.
I feel like
no
it's the whole baseball, the
about.
National
you
know? American League,
right,
you know,
right,
the
exactly.
football competing
but they,
league.
They got into this radical, one was federal, one was state, one was against, one was for, no men, some men. And they just weren't talking to each other for about 20 years. They didn't come back together again until 1890.
The League of Women Voters began in the exact same year that the 19th Amendment passed, and that was in 1920.
Yep.
The League of Women Voters' birthday is February 14th, Valentine's Day.
How sweet!
And the 19th Amendment passed on August 26th, later that year, by one vote in Tennessee.
Do you want to hear the story about that one vote?
I bet Jennifer knows it.
Oh, I love it. I love it. It is such a cool story.
Give us the story.
Okay, here's what happened. I like stories. The 19th Amendment got ratified nationally. Then it had to go state by state. They needed to have two-thirds of the states, okay? Everybody looked at what states were most likely, and it looked like Tennessee was the one. Poor Tennessee, 1924, then they got the Scopes trial, same thing. Okay, anyway, everybody converges upon Tennessee, and it's a madhouse, and there are anti-suffragists and pro-suffragists. And the Speaker of the House said, okay, I'm going to do an end run about this whole thing. We're going to put this to a vote. Are we going to vote now, or are we going to table this entire issue until the next legislative session? Two votes went by. The vote was split, 48 to 48. And then somebody said, oh, this is ridiculous. We are going to vote on the 19th Amendment right now. We're not going to vote on whether we're just going to table the discussion. We're going to vote on the amendment. Well, so everybody's like, whoa, my God, what's going to happen? Pardon my French. One young man named Harry Byrne, 24 years old, youngest member of the legislature. Nobody knew quite how he was going to vote. And it came to the actual vote, and he said, yes. And his was the ratifying vote. He was only 24. And what's really amusing is that afterwards he said that the reason he did it was because his mother had written him a letter earlier that day. She'd gone to college, and she had said, give them what they want. Don't make them wait. I know you're a good boy. And then she had some little joke, love mama. And he said afterwards that he knew that one of the things that was important in life was that a boy always obey the advice of his mother.
All right.
He also said a couple of other things which I thought were lovely, and I wish we could hear them now. And if I can find them, I'm going to read them fast because I just think they're really good. He basically was very honored. He said that, I hope I have him here. This page, too many pages.
Jennifer is definitely a researcher.
I'm going to let Harry go by because I don't want to take up too much time. But anyway, we can all thank Harry Byrne for the 19th Amendment.
Yes, we can.
So we definitely don't have time in this episode, but having a degree in African American studies, we know that that split that happened with the amendment and African American males getting the vote really still causes some fracturing in the unification we could have in 2019 between women's groups.
We still haven't passed the ERA.
Right.
We're still fighting the same battles.
So we definitely know that not everyone who was in favor of women getting the right to vote had the same feelings about different ethnic groups, racial groups. I thought one of the powerful things, the event we had at the YWCA, and Tucson is less racial diversity than I was used to living in an urban area in Ohio. It's particularly for African Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just so fewer here. And so it was interesting. I thought the one lady stood up and said, let's remember as we go, yay, yay, women got the vote, that we don't forget as we go forward with that to reflect women who didn't get the vote when we're doing our celebrations.
Well, they did get the vote. It was that the states prevented them from voting.
Exactly. Yeah. And that conflict.
When there was actually a parade for women's suffrage in 1913, there was an argument about where black women were going to march. And Ida B. Wells, who was a journalist and a political activist at the time, she was with the Illinois delegation, and some of the women objected. And she said, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for my race. Mm-hmm. And as soon as everybody lined up and the parade began to move, she went right into the Illinois delegation and marched with them. You know, but everybody was saying, no, you should be at the back of the parade. She was going, no.
So we continue to face those challenges today. In the education topics that we talked about, it's nothing new. My mother and I laugh all the time. She's an avid watcher of a variety of Law and Orders. And so, you know, you're watching something for like 20 years ago. And she goes, oh my gosh, it's the same daggone thing, right? You know, it's like the such and such immigrant, the such and such this, where they hear illegally, you know, the powerful newspaper person or, you know, I mean, it's like it's the same.
Icons. That's not the word I want, but the same stereotypes.
Yes, it's the same. Yes, it's the archetypes. That's what we're looking for. Yeah. The Jungian archetypes. Yeah. Elevate it.
So this is a show for business women.
It is.
And I wanted to mention a few things that have happened along the way since the 19th Amendment passed that specifically relates to business women. In 1963, the United States passed the first legislation requiring equal pay for equal work. Still working on that.
Yeah.
But in 1972, that's when it was actually expanded for salespeople and executives and administrators. In 1968, I remember looking at want ads, and there were male and female want ads. Mm-hmm. In 1968, it became illegal to place help wanted ads specifying gender in our country. In 1972, Catherine Graham... Remember her?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Washington Post.
She was with the Washington Post, exactly. Mm-hmm. She became the first woman to become CEO of a Fortune 500 company. That meant in 1972, there were 499 men who were the CEOs and a grand total of one woman.
And if I can interject here, we have not come as far on that as we've wanted to. In the last week, Forbes released the 100 most influential business people, and there was one female on the list of 100.
Mm. Wow.
And the statistic they gave said there are twice as many people named Stanley on this list as there are women, and there's two Stanleys. And within about... which I thought was a clever way to put it. I mean, that sticks in your mind, right? That's a story, Jennifer, that sticks in your mind.
There you go.
So very quickly... A power of social media would be that, you know, Forbes vets this list. You know, that's not one person. It had to be green lighted. They had to agree. Oh, is Vivian going to be first and Jennifer sixth? Who's going to be where on what? You know, and for whatever reason, this is the 100 they come up with. And I don't even recall who the one female was. I'm sad to say I didn't bother, because what happened was journalists, and one of the power of social media is that story comes out. It's a headline. Immediately, in less than half an hour, multiple activist journalists are like, I'm sorry, let me rephrase your headline and have a list of 100 influential entrepreneur women business types and say, sure. And then what happened was when that person, one of the first people to put the list out, people kept adding to it, right? And her list was growing and growing and growing. Yep. And a lot of influential people, I hadn't known that journalist's name before, but a lot of influential people that I follow and respect their opinions. And so I think the time frame for that, right? Like, that is the power of social media, yes. Is that you can immediately not just fact check, but concept check, right? Because their concept, yes. It's not, you don't get a Forbes article in 10 minutes, right? There's editors and there's people that verify stuff. And that through all that process, my sister and I, we were going to start a show and called Who Does That? We still may do a podcast called Who Does That? And just talk about ludicrous things people do, right? Like, how did that get green in our industry, greenlit, right? Like, you have a video or you have an idea or you have marketing, and probably because I envisioned Darren Stevens from Bewitched pitching his ideas to Larry Tate. For those of you who aren't the right age range, you won't remember. And he had to come home and get his cocktail from Samantha. But it was always like, how do you get this idea? Oh, that idea is not good for Madison Avenue or wherever it was he worked. And you see stuff now, and I'm like, there was a room of people who had to approve this idea, and then they had to fund it, and then they had to go create it. And no one said, this is lunacy. Like, I feel like we need more people saying, you know, stop, wait, pause. What are we doing?
You know, my answer to that is, of course, to almost anything these days, follow the money.
Oh, exactly. And and that's the advantage of having that diversity. I love what you said, Vivian, about the League of Women Voters taking issues that you feel are important to the thriving well-being of a community, the parents, the children, the people who don't have children, the people, what supports a community and what a community is supported by.
Exactly.
you know, for me, it's the power of libraries. Columbus, Ohio had three national ranked between, you know, sort of suburbs, three nationally ranked libraries for population demographic.
Lucky
and they
you.
Were like number one for a decade. Oh. I mean, I was so spoiled by the library system there. And I've been excited to see how Tucson has really been investing in doing some things to improve. We didn't have seeds at our library, to my knowledge. But one of the things I recently saw that libraries are doing, there was a library and they had cake pan. Like there's things you can take out from libraries that aren't books.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so it was this whole baking equipment. Someone posted it again on social media and someone said, what library is this? And then maybe seven librarians were like, our library has something very similar to this.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
ways in which borrowable things mm-hmm. help families, you know.
Right. And they become social centers as well
exactly.
as just libraries.
So I just think we have, for me, the power is the rapidness with which we can tell stories. And we know there's a downside to that, right? Because then something that's erroneous can go very quickly, even from, you know, sites with authority and vested histories in them. And that could be a whole rabbit hole in another show. But Vivian, you had a couple other things, I think, that you were going to share about women in business, some kind of legal things.
A couple things.
Yeah.
1974, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act passed. Before then, banks could not give credit to women. They had to have the signature of their husbands, and they didn't give money to women, single women, at all. And if they did consider how much wages that a woman made, they would discount it by 50%, even if she was the main breadwinner. 1978, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was passed in our country.
I mean, 1978. When I saw some of these years prepping for today,
women
I was
could
like,
still
holy
be
moly.
Legally dismissed from their jobs for becoming pregnant up to 1978. And then the last one I want to mention is in 2009, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay
yes.
Restoration Act was passed. And what that was Lilly Ledbetter worked in Goodyear. And she worked there for years, for decades. And her pay as a supervisor was lower than the lowest paid man of comparable seniority. And there was a law at that time that, yeah, if you found out within 6 months that you were paid less, then you could sue. But if it took longer than 6 months, you're out of luck. So what this law said was you can sue companies for pay discrimination if it's even over that 180 days. Because how many people really do talk about how much money they're making at their company?
Oh, money's the big taboo subject.
Exactly. And so you don't know. And
exactly.
so she didn't find out till later. So those are some of the things. Now, Susan wanted to talk about units for...
But I think we're
almost out of time, if you can believe it. We only have
right.
like a minute and a half left.
Right, exactly.
So any just closing comments from the guests today that
vote.
You would like
vote?
Vote
every
right?
chance you get.
I think the other time, just register and vote. And people are like, I said, no, I want everyone to register and I want every vote counted and I want everyone to vote. Even if I so categorically, if Jennifer and I didn't agree on one single solitary thing, I want her to register and vote. I
Go
truly
to
do.
The polls I already have. And I want cast you to know. Your vote. Time to have your say. Let your voice be heard now. We can make such a beautiful day.
Oh, I got
we can create
that.
Such a beautiful way. Get out and vote.
I'm telling you, singing to close the song, I, that is
go.
A first for us. I just cannot thank you.
I can
you.
See it. League of Women Voters, the musical.
Exactly. Jennifer, Susan, Vivian, I cannot thank you enough for joining me today. Just that little bit that I got, as I said, at the YWCA, and I thought, you know, why haven't you talked to League of Women Voters? You know about this. You support what they do. How do we get them in? How do we kind of get business women realizing that that work, having a federal law, opens the door for other federal law to be in place. And while maybe in your community or your personal life, you haven't experienced it, open your eyes a little bit to that broader world so that everybody can have that access. So thank you all for your time. I'm Jessica Badowski with Two Busy Gals. This is our show, Ask the Gals, on Tucson Business Radio X. Feel free to join us next month where we've already got two guests. I cannot even believe a 70-year-old female international jet pilot that was hired in her late 60s to fly international cargo planes.
Awesome.
I know. You guys are going to want to check in. It's like, I met her today at lunch, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you have to be on the podcast. And the lady next to her owns a company that does Euro planes, but not like Euro, like a sandwich, at some sort of gyro helicoptery. I don't know that much about aeronautics, so I'll get up to speed before we have the show, so I sound a little more intellectual.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.